They're closing the doors on us now, so that means I think it's time to start. How's everybody this morning? Good? It rained a lot, actually. Not quite that many. I think we'd be in trouble in Florida. We don't have the elevation really necessary for that, that kind of rain. So, glad to see you're still here. You came in your rowboats this morning. And we're studying the book of Wilderness. Other people call it Numbers. It was originally called Wilderness. It's more fun than Numbers. It's a better title, I think. And when we talk about the book of Numbers, what time period are we talking about? Do y'all remember? What are we dealing with here? 39 years, exactly. And what 39 years specifically in the history of the Israelite people? Yes, the 39 years that they're in the wilderness. And we're going to talk about why today, why they were that long in the wilderness, and some other interesting things. And so right now, we're in chapter 10. Beginning in verse 11 is where we're going to start today. Now remember, we talked about chapter 1, verse 1, until chapter 10, verse 10. They are still at the base of Mount Sinai. Okay, they've been there for a while. The end of Exodus, they're there. Leviticus, they're there. And then the first 10 chapters, they're at Sinai still. And while they're there, they're given the law, they're building the tabernacle, they're preparing. And chapter 1 through 10, we see more preparations that are being made. We see preparations on how they are supposed to camp. Do you remember how they're supposed to camp? By tribes, yes. And could they find just any old flat spot? How are they supposed to camp? In what way? Or let's say this. What was the center of the camp of the tribe of Israel? The tabernacle, right? Remember, they divided up into camps by tribes. You had those to the north, south, east, and west. Who camped directly around the tabernacle? Do you remember which tribe?
The Levites,
exactly right. The Levites camped right around, and they were actually a barrier. The Lord said they were a barrier so that nobody would come and approach their tabernacle. And then the priests, the high priest, Moses and his sons, Aaron and his sons, and Moses also camped near the door on the east side of the tabernacle. And so, you know, metaphorically, you had to come through them to approach God. And so that's a metaphor there. Anyway, so that's how they camped. Now, we're going to look here in chapter 10, verse 11. And it says, "Now in the second year, in the second month, on the 20th of the month, the cloud was lifted." What's the significance of the cloud being lifted? They were going to set out. Now, what was the cloud? Do you remember? God. It was the presence of God. And we were told earlier in chapter 9, verse 22, that they were supposed to leave whenever the cloud left, right? So, you know, we got previous information about what the significance of the cloud moving meant. It wasn't some random, that cloud looks like a bunny, and it left. It wasn't that kind of thing. It was the cloud that represented God that stayed, the presence of God left, and they were to move also. And it said, "It moved from over the tabernacle of testimony, and the sons of Israel set out on their journeys from the wilderness of Sinai, then the cloud settled down in the wilderness of Paran. So they moved out for the first time according to the commandment of the Lord through Moses." And here again we see this chain of command. As we see throughout these five books, the commandment of the Lord through Moses. Now, I want to touch on something that was brought to my attention. I meant to say earlier, and I just... spaced on saying this. But as you look here, beginning of verse 14, you have the four different camps, right? Four different camps. And how many tribes are in each camp? Three. The math on that is 12. Yeah, I've had that much caffeine, I can at least do that this morning. Now, that's 12. And where are the Levites? Where do they camp? around the tabernacle. How many is that? 12 plus 1 is 13. How many sons did Israel or Jacob have? 12. Wait a second. How does that work? Do you remember? Okay. Very good. Let's look over in Genesis real quick. It's not that we can't count. Genesis chapter 48. Genesis chapter 48, we have here an event that kind of gives us some information on to why things happen. Look in Genesis chapter 48, verse 5. And these are the last days of Jacob, Israel, as his name was. Somebody read verse 5 for us, if you would. Anybody want to read Genesis 48, verse 5? All right. So what this is, again, this is Jacob as his last days, and he's going to be blessing his sons. And he takes these two. So you don't see the tribe of Joseph, do you? When you're reading through the list, there is no tribe of Joseph. He is represented by his two sons. And what are their names again? Ephraim and Manasseh. Okay, so these we do see. So that's how we get the 13, and that's how we get the tribe of Levi separated. Remember, they had given the tribe of Levi for the use of God. The tribe of Levi was consecrated for the use, the sacred use, of the tabernacle temple. And we looked at that last time, and that really plays a part in when Peter talks about us being a royal priesthood, consecrated for the use of God. And so this brings that to light. And so here, they begin to embark. And we were told that they were not only just given instructions as to where they camped, but they were also given instruction as to how they marched, marching orders. And so here we have them beginning to go out for the first time. And so in verse 14, the standard of the camp of the sons of Judah, or the camp of Judah, according to their armies, set out first, with Nashon, the son of Adonad, over this army, and Ethiel, the son of Zur, over the tribal armies of Issachar. Zebulun also went out with this time. And so here they are. So here, and Gershon also is here. So that group goes out first, and they have their standard. What's a standard? It kind of has two meanings, right?
Like a sign.
A sign. The Romans had a standard, you know, that they would march in front of their armies with. And they had a standard that would say, this is us. When you go to Disney, you'll see a standard of people with tours and all the Brazilians on that tour being loud and crazy and that kind of stuff. And she'll be holding up. Nobody goes to Disney, apparently. Okay. But that's what happens. You know, you have the tour things, that sign that people say, oh, here's this tour. The Amway tour is going this way. You know, that kind of stuff. So it's that kind of idea here. So here's the standard that's being held up. So they know that that tribe is leaving. What else did they have as a signal that it's time to leave? There were two of them, and they were silver. The trumpets. The trumpets we read about earlier. They would blow in a certain way and let them know that they were leaving. Okay, so here they have them leaving out for the first time. They've been in this place for a while. They're having to pull their stakes out of the ground and get everything packed up and ready to go. And so they're leaving. Okay, and they leave in order. And as they leave, where do the holy objects, where are they placed in this file as they leave out? Do you remember? Verse 17, then the tabernacle was taken down, and the sons of Gershon and the sons of Merari were carrying the tabernacle. And so they were actually, and the Kohathites set out in verse 21, carrying the holy objects, and the tabernacle was set up before their arrival. And so they were placed in such an order that the holy objects were in the very center of the file, of the column. And then you had another group, the standard of Dan in verse 25. They were at the rear to protect the rear as they marched. And so, again, this is how they were supposed to march. These were the marching orders. Now, as they left, we have an interesting event take place in verse 29. Then Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel, the Midianite. You may know him more as Jethro, is his other name. Moses' father-in-law. We are setting out to the place which the Lord said, I will give it to you. Come with us, and we will go, and we will do you good, for the Lord has promised concerning Israel. But he said to him, I will not come, but rather will go to my own land and relatives. And then he said, please do not leave us, inasmuch as you know where we should camp in the wilderness, and you will be as eyes for us. So it will be, if you go with us, that wherever whatever good the Lord does for us, we will do for you. And so he goes with him, and sort of like a scout, so to speak. Now as they leave, look here in the end of chapter 10. Verse 35, then it came about when the ark set out that Moses said, rise up, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you. When it came to rest, he said, return, O Lord, to the myriad thousands of Israel. All right, look at Psalm 68 while we're here. Psalm 68. Beginning in verse 1, let God arise, let his enemies be scattered, let those who hate him flee before him. As smoke is driven away, so drive them away. As wax melts before the fire, so let the wicked perish before God. But let the righteous be glad, let them exult before God. Yes, let them rejoice with gladness. Sing to God, sing praises to his name. Lift up a song for him who rides through the deserts, whose name is the Lord, and exalt before him. And it goes on to talk about attributes of God and how he takes care of those who are his. And we see David uses this concept as God goes before him. He prays and this kind of prayer, go before us as we go. I think that's an interesting concept to think about, God going before us. God take care of us. That providential care. Yes, sir.
He's right away.
Mm-hmm. Yep. They were numbered specifically according to their armies and organized, you know, by their armies, and then, you know, their families and that kind of stuff went with them, obviously. But yes, it is interesting. We can make some applications to that for us today also. But here's David, very much a man of war, understands that God plays a part in every aspect. God goes before us. Be the God that goes before us. Read the rest of that psalm. Not now because we're studying wilderness, but later on, read the rest of that psalm and look how God goes before different people. And that's an interesting prayer that we can pray as well. All right, so chapter 11, we begin really this cycle. Chapter 11 through chapter 25, we have this new section, the cycle of rebellion, death, and deliverance. Fun times, okay? So we're going to start reading about some people who don't necessarily do what pleases God, and we're going to see how God reacts to that, and it's going to be an interesting study. What chapter heading, or what kind of heading do you have? They're not inspired, obviously, but what heading do you have for chapter 11? The people complain, do you have that, or something like to that effect? Yes, that is the result of complaining. What? Yes, that's the reason they're complaining. So we're gonna look here what happens. Look in verse 1. Now the people became like those who complain of adversity. I think that's a pretty interesting title. It's not like they were that, but they became that. All right. They became like those people that complain when things aren't going their way. As you know, that would be the Josh version of this. In the hearing of the Lord, and when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. The people therefore cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died out. So the name of the place was called Taberah, because the fire of the Lord burned among them. That name means the burning. So that place became known as the burning place. So they complained. And remember we talked about there is this fire, this presence of God, okay, that marks when at night that is above the tabernacle. They complained in the hearing of the Lord. It's not like, and that which is ironic because God would always hear. But they complained. It wasn't like this to themselves. It was vocal complaining. And God was angry with them. Have you ever been in a situation where people were complaining and it kind of perturbed you that they were complaining? Yes. And we're going to see a lot of that. We're going to see Moses here in just a second be rather vexed at the complaining of the people. So God was angry with them, and he had every right to be angry with them. It's like, I'm providing so much for you, and you're ungrateful little kids. Okay, so here we go. Verse 4, this is an interesting concept. The rabble who were among them had greedy desires, and also the sons of Israel wept again and said, who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we used to eat free in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic, the orangutans, whatever, but now our appetite is gone. There's nothing at all to look at except this manna. So here is their complaining. Remember when God, let's look over when God gave them manna. Look in Exodus 16. Exodus 16. Verse 18 and 19. When they had measured it with an omer, he who had gathered much had no excess, and he who gathered little had no lack. Every man gathered as much as he should eat. Moses said to them, let no man leave any of it until morning. So we're talking about this manna was given in verse 16. But also they were given manna in the morning and quail at night. So they had this light, sweet bread, is how they described it, in the morning for breakfast, and they would gather it for what they needed for the day. And they would have Cornish hens in the evening for dinner. Now, when we go fast forward to what's happening here in Numbers, they're talking like that's like manna is all they have. Like they don't have any quail or anything. Like God's not providing them meat already. Okay? So they do have some meat, but they just don't have what they want. Again, can we make examples of this? Can we draw conclusions about, you know, sometimes we're fickle and we just never get enough of what we want. You know, God provides and we're like, oh, that's great. And then you get used to that and you're like, oh, it's just not enough. I got to have more. And so we can see this analogy being drawn out here. But the rabble, who is the rabble? What is this rabble that we're talking about here? What other words do you have there instead of rabble in your versions? Is it all mixed multitude? Look over in Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12. verse 38. And a mixed multitude also went up with them, along with the flocks and herds, a very large number of livestock. And so when they left Egypt, there was this group of people that went with them that were not Israelites, that were, you know, other slaves or whatever that were there in Egypt. And so imagine yourself, you see everything that's happening, the 10 plagues come, the God of this guy Moses comes in, and Moses says, you know, we're gonna leave. And you're just a guy on the sideline watching everything happen. You're not with those people. You're not one of the Israelites. Your neighbor may be an Israelite, but you're not. And you're just kind of watching everything unfold. And they pretty much decimate every Egyptian god with all of these different plagues. And then the Egyptians basically pay them to leave because they give them all this gold and stuff as they leave. Are you going to stay there in Egypt? I think it'd be a good time to leave, all right? Hey, their gods just smoke-checked, you know, these guys over here. I think I'm going to go with them. I think I'll go with them. And so this group of people also leave with them. Now, they don't have any part in promise, and that's, again, why throughout the giving of the law and stuff, there is this mention of, you know, other people who are there. If somebody else comes in among you and wants to partake of the Passover, remember we read that last time, they can on this certain time. And so here's this concept. So here's a rabble that goes with them. Now, they're a bad influence, this rabble. And so here we see that they're a bad influence on the people. Let's look over at 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Over and over again in the New Testament, this wilderness period is given as an example or a warning to us today. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Beginning in verse 1, "For I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them. The rock was Christ," and so here was a symbolism. "Nevertheless, most of them God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. Now these things happened as an example for us, so that we would not crave evil things as they also craved." And so it goes on to talk about idolatry and things of that nature. But here is this craving for it's like, why? You got to have everything. All these little things, we're camping, you know. This is not like, you know, the Hilton. So they're intense. But God's response is rather interesting, how he responds. In verse 7, it talks about what manna was like. "Now, manna was like coriander seed, and its appearance was like that of bdellium. And the people would go out and gather it and grind it between two millstones, beating it with mortar, and boil it in the pot and make it cakes with it. And its taste was like the taste of cakes baked with oil." We would call those donuts. So God gave him Krispy Kremes in the morning and Cornish hens for dinner. That's a pretty good gig, right? Now, you're walking off those calories, okay? It's not like you're just sitting around. You're walking that off. But so this is what God provided for them.
They wouldn't have risen, so it'd be more like a pizza dough.
Yes, it'd be like a crispier Krispy Kreme, right?
No, it'd be flat.
Yeah, whoever. I'm just, you know, yeah. They maybe put a hole in the middle of it, maybe. Anyway, we're getting way off track here. Now, Moses begins to complain because the people are complaining in verse 10. And this is kind of, I think a lot of us can relate to what Moses is saying here. "Now, Moses heard the people weeping throughout their families, each man at the doorway of his tent." You know, that would be interesting. Literally, every man was at the door of his tent just weeping and wailing because, oh, we don't have what we want. That would be an interesting sight to see once, maybe. Lord was kindled greatly, and Moses was displeased. So Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you been so hard on your servant?" Who is this? Who is his servant? Me. "Why have you been so hard on me?" Now Moses begins to complain. Moses doesn't like anybody complaining, and then what does Moses do? He begins to complain. "No, I understand. It's frustrating. It makes you just want to hit a rock every once in a while, right? If you had to deal with these kind of people." That was a preacher joke. You'll get that later, maybe. Okay. "And why have I not found favor in your sight that you have laid the burden of all these people on me? Was it I who conceived all these people? Was it I who brought them forth that you should say to me, 'Carry them in your bosom,' as in a nurse carrying a nursing infant, to the land which you swore to their fathers? Where am I to get meat to give to all these people? For they weep before me, saying, 'Give us meat that we may eat.' I alone am not able to carry all these people, because it is too burdensome for me. So if you are going to deal with us thus with me, please kill me at once." Signed, Moses. Okay, so here is Moses' response. It's a little bit extreme, right? It's a little bit extreme. Now, he's dealing with millions of people that are screaming and wailing and they want meat. And the people are coming to him all the time. "Hey, we want some meat." And they're complaining, "Well, we're just going to leave. We don't have some meat." And so here is Moses' situation. Moses is like, why? You know, why me? Why do I have to be this guy? It's like, they're not my kids. They're not mine. Okay, I can kill him right now. But Moses is like, just kill me. Just take me out of the equation and we'll be good. All right? A little bit extreme. Okay? And so God says, as a response to this, the Lord therefore said to Moses, gather for me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom you know to be elders of the people and their officers, and bring them to the tent of meeting, and let them take their stand with you. And so he begins to prepare a council, so there's a barrier between Moses and the people as far as dealing with just all this stuff. And this is exactly what Jethro told Moses he needed to do in Exodus 18. Exodus 18, 15 through 26, Jethro said, this is too much for you, dude. You cannot carry all these people. You need some people, you know, kind of like, you know, around you. So this is a father-in-law talking to a son-in-law, and now the son-in-law understands, hey, we need to put this in place. And so God is saying, here's what we're going to do, and we're going to do it this way. So God helps take care of Moses, and he says, and they, in verse 17, and they shall bear the burden of the people with you. And he says, it begins to say in verse 18, oh, that someone would give us meat to eat, for we are well off in Egypt. Therefore, the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. You shall eat not one day, nor 2 days, not 5 days, nor 10 days, nor 20 days, but a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you and have wept before him, saying, Why did we ever leave Egypt? But Moses said to the people among whom I am, are 600,000 on foot, that you have said, I will give them meat, so they will have meat the whole month, should flocks. And so the Lord said to Moses, the Lord is the Lord's power limited? So Moses begins to ask, how are you going to give them all this meat? You promised them a lot. Here's 6,000 men, 600,000 men, not including everything else. And you promised them meat. How is that going to happen? And God's like, is the Lord's power limited? Now you shall see whether my word will come true for you or not. And so the Lord gave those over to those men, and then the 70, and then there were two, Eldad and Medad, that were not actually there, but they were given that measure of the Spirit also, that they were able to lead. And then in verse 31, we have the quail coming in. In verse 31, now there went forth a wind from the Lord, and it brought quail from the sea, and let them fall beside the camp about a day's journey on this side and a day's journey on the other side. Now, all around the camp, about 2 cubits deep on the surface of the ground. Now, let me look. A wind comes and brings quail. Not a little bit. But as far as you can travel for a day on that side of the camp, which the camp wasn't small to begin with, and as far as you can travel for a day all around the camp, 2 cubits deep, which is about 36 inches of meat. You want meat? Here you go, right? Here's you some meat. You're going to be so tired of it, like he says, it's going to be coming out of your nose. Here's you some meat. You can't tell me God was a little bit sarcastic here with the people went, spent all day and all night, all the next day, and gathered quail. He who gathered least gathered 10 homers, which is not a unit of measurement we use. I'll take 1 homer, please. No, we don't use that unit of measurement. But what that would be, 1 homer is about 13.6 cubic feet. 1 homer, 13.6 cubic feet. And he who gathered least gathered 10. We're talking truckloads, which it wasn't that hard, really. I mean, you just had to go like this, you know. You had to plow. Were they dead? I wonder what they were like. So here's these dead birds all around you. I don't know. And then you had to pluck them. Have any of you plucked a bird before? I think I'd go directly to skinning those things. I don't think I'd even mess with the feathers, but... So you had to shovel. I imagine just shoveling birds, you know, with this big. I don't know how this worked. I know they were not plastic wrapped. I'm imagining they were not. They don't come with a public sticker on them. But here is all this food The least gathered 10 homers. And they spread them out for themselves all around the camp. And while the meat was still between their teeth. Now, I think that what they were probably doing was spreading them out to dry. Which they had to kick other birds out of the way, so they had place for them to do that. And when I see this verse, while the food was still in their teeth, it makes me think of Lord of the Rings, anybody? Anybody watch Lord of the Rings? Okay, some of us. Some of you looking at me like, you're such a geek. And I'm like, yes, I am, yes. So Lord of the Rings, there is a moment when there's this little guy, Gollum, who eats fish raw. And it shows a close-up of him eating fish raw with his teeth and just eating it. That's what I imagine seeing these people. That's what I see in my mind when I see while the meat was still between their teeth before it was chewed even. The anger of the Lord was kindled against the people, and the Lord struck the people with a very severe plague. So the name of the place was called Kirith Hatava, because there were graves of greediness, is what this was called. Graves of greediness. They buried the people who had been greedy. And so they set out from there after that. So lesson learned here. What did we learn? What's the moral of the story in this situation? Be content. Don't complain, because God's going to give you way more than you really need, right? So don't complain. Don't be greedy. There are graves of greediness is what this place was called. It wasn't called the place, hey, this is a cool place where we got a lot of birds. That wasn't the name of this place. The lesson learned was greediness. Yes?
Was this giving of all this quail separate from the morning quail at night?
Yes, it was separate from... From what I understand, I believe they had, and that's why it's sort of interesting that they're complaining about this. What's also interesting is that all this stuff they want is in the land that they're going to. So if they would just chill for a little bit and get over there and get to work, they would have all this stuff. Again, more application. Yes, ma'am.
I think that was more of a punishment for the people. All that
quail. Oh, yeah.
That was
definitely... Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, this was very much a punishment. And he even said, you're going to be so tired of quail. I don't know if you've ever eaten one thing and it's gotten to the point where you can no longer eat that one item. My mother or my grandmother used to give me those, like, little candies, butterscotch candies. Loved them. I'm just now starting to be able to eat them again. I ate so many of them, couldn't eat them again. But here's the situation. They were going to be loathing the stuff. And they were going to get all this stuff when they went to the land. The same thing for us. We look for, hey, I want this. I want to be happy. I want happiness. I want to be taken care of. I want to retire. I want to do all this kind of stuff, which in and of themselves are not bad. But if that becomes our focus, God's like, would you just chill? Because as soon as you die and transition on, I've given you a rest. I've provided you all this stuff. I've built you a mansion. You're going to be set up. Just get through the wilderness. Same thing for us, right? Just get through the wilderness. Do what I say to do. Walk the way I tell you to walk. Talk the way I tell you to talk. Get through the wilderness, and you'll get your leeks and orangutans and all that kind of stuff on the other side, okay? Just get through it. So here is... Yes, sir?
I think it's also strange that all of that generation didn't make it anyway.
Oh, yeah, we're gonna get there. We're getting there. And yeah, you're exactly right. We're fast-forwarding one chapter on that, but we'll get to that exactly. And it is interesting that they did not, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But in chapter 12, we begin this murmuring. Again, we have a lot of murmuring in the wilderness section. And right now, we have the murmuring of Miriam and Aaron. In verse 1, it says, then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman, it put in parentheses there in case we didn't catch that, and they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well? All right, now, we know that he married Jethro's daughter, Zipporah, right? In Exodus 2, verse 21, is where it tells us, but we don't really hear much about her. Even in when he's over in Egypt in Exodus, we don't really hear anything about her. And so some have surmised that she passed away, that he married this Cushite woman later on, maybe even in Egypt. And so they're picking at Moses. What is the real reason here? What's the real reason we're picking up? Is it because of this, his wife?
No, jealous.
They're jealous, yes. And we see that here. It says, has the Lord spoken only to Moses? Okay, and we see Miriam was a prophetess also. In Exodus 15, verse 20, after they had crossed the Red Sea, we're given that information that she was a prophetess also. She's maybe a little bit jealous about what's going on, why Moses gets all the attention. And if she had come to him later on, you know, earlier in chapter 11, he'd be like, hey, take them. They're yours, right? And so here's what's happening. This jealousy arises. And verse 3, now the man Moses was very humble, more than any man who was on the face of the earth, which a humble man would be, you know, God told him to write that. This is inspired. It wasn't like Moses said, hey, I'm a humble guy, you know, and wrote that. God told him to write that. And as he wrote it, I can imagine Moses writing it and saying, seriously, God, I have to write that down? If he's that humble, he's probably not going to want to write that. You can put out to the side of that Matthew 11, 29. Jesus says a very similar thing, Matthew 11, 29. Meek and lowly in heart. In verse 4, so the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, or suddenly to the three of Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, you three come out to the tent of meeting. You've just been called by God to go to the tent. How many of you have been called out to the woodshed before? Okay, I mean, this is that kind of thing, okay? And if you don't know what I'm talking about, we'll talk afterwards, okay? So they got called out to the woodshed, basically. In verse 5, then the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud and stood at the doorway of the tent. Now, this is really serious. This is not normal, okay? So you get called by God to the doorway of the tabernacle, and then the cloud comes down to the front. I don't know about you, but when I was a child, when I, you know, the woodshed moments, and Dad comes in, I was a little bit intimidated. And this would be even much more so than that. So God normally is above the tabernacle, and he comes down in front and begins to say, hey, this is what's happening. Then the Lord came down the tent, and he called Aaron and Miriam, and they, when they had both come forward, even worse, they get called by name, and they have to walk closer. Hear now my words. If there's a prophet among you, I, the Lord, shall make myself known to him in a vision. I shall speak with him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my household. With him I speak mouth to mouth, even openly, and not in dark sayings. And he beholds the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant, against Moses? Put out that aside there, Deuteronomy 34:10. We do not have enough time. Deuteronomy 34:10, as far as Moses speaking face-to-face with God in a close relationship. And he says, this is the kind of relationship I have with my servant Moses. Why are you not afraid to speak against him? There should be some respect given to this man. And they're not giving it to him. Sisters are like that sometimes, I imagine. So the anger of the Lord burned against them, and he departed. But when the cloud had withdrawn from over the tent, behold, Miriam was leprous. Now it's interesting, he says he departed, capital H, God left, and then it mentions the cloud being gone. Why would those be connected? That's the physical vision of God, okay? When they know when God's around, when that cloud's there, okay? That's the presence of God on earth and that concept. And so the cloud was gone, and Miriam was leprous, as white as snow. Then Aaron said to Moses, O my Lord, I beg you, do not account this sin to us in which we have acted foolishly and in which we have sinned. We have sinned. And so they cry out. Moses cried out to the Lord in verse 13, O God, heal her, I pray. But the Lord said to Moses, if her father had but spit in her face, would she not bear her shame for 7 days or be unclean? for 7 days. Let her be shut up for 7 days outside the camp. Afterwards, she may be received again. So Miriam was shut up outside the camp for 7 days. And so they didn't move from that place. They camped there. Now, at the end of this chapter, verse 16, afterward, however, the people moved from Hazeroth and camped in the wilderness of Paran, and they arrived. Now, it should, according to Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 2, it should have taken them 11 days to get there. That's how long the travel should, 11-ish days, okay? But it took them about 3 months. And we know this because in Numbers 13, verse 25, they bring back grapes, and grapes don't really get mature until about September. So we know about how long it took for them to get over into this wilderness-ish, about 3 months. It took them a lot longer than it should have because they had a few stops along the way. They had to gather quail. They had, you know, they had all this other kind of stuff that happened in their travels. And so we will have to wrap things up here before we get 13. Now, 13, if y'all want to read ahead, 13 and 14, we deal with the spies going into the land. We deal with the why they were in the wilderness so long. We're going to, I think, deal with the rebellion of Korah if we have enough time to get over to chapter 16. Any questions, comments? Yes. Yeah, you know, I don't know either. I think maybe, I mean, we were given what Miriam's physically said, you know, and Aaron may have been kind of the yes guy over there. And Aaron kind of has that, you know, yeah, I got Adam and Eve kind of thing. But Aaron is that guy on the back that is there but doesn't want to get in trouble, you know. Like, with the golden calf situation, they made me do it. You know, we just threw it into the fire and it came out. We didn't really make it a golden calf. So he's that kind of guy. So I imagine he kind of... He was just the yes man. You know, when Miriam spoke out, she was just kind of, yeah, you're right, you know, kind of thing. All right, you are dismissed. Thank you very much.